Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This week's episode of Screen Talk is brought to you by Amazon Studios, presenting Time, now nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature and hailed by IndieWire as the most essential documentary of 2020. Time is the most honored documentary of the year, winner of Best Documentary by the Gotham Awards, National Board of Review, Los Angeles Film Critics, National Society of Film Critics, and winner of two IDA Awards, including Best Director Garrett Bradley. Time is streaming on Prime Video. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And in this very long Oscar season, we are in some of the final phases here, but there's still plenty to talk about, recapping SAG, other kinds of stuff that's going on with various frontrunners and so forth. But first, you were on sort of the front lines this past week at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, so to speak, as a moderator. So how did it go out there for that stage of the usual award season shuffle? Some things never change.
Yeah, no, instead of, actually, I am going to be going up there today. I'm going to go up there and do a tribute to Delroy Lindo, which
a
I'm
real
delighted
life in person
to do.
Thing. Yeah, that's
no,
wild.
No, it's weird. No? They're putting me in, you don't get paid to do these things. It's actually a lot of work.
Journalistic integrity.
That's right. And so they put me up at the El Encanto Hotel and, you know, buy me dinner. But they're going to make me look good in the hotel. They're going to, you know, so you don't have to look at my office anymore. And it looks like everybody looks
office.
The same. They have Leonard Maltin up there. They have Pete Hammond. They have Scott Feinberg. You know, we're the gang of moderators at the Santa Barbara Film Festival.
But and the I talent, always do you're saying the talent's not
two.
There.
No, nobody's there.
There is
an in-person
element.
Director is there. Yeah,
okay,
they're
so
just
something.
Moving. Yeah, they're making me change my location.
Yeah.
But I'll be remote. I'll still be remote as they're just going to set up
remote from Santa Barbara.
Hotel.
Well, that's worth something.
Yeah. And then, you know, I went and last weekend digitally, we did the writer's panel, which is my favorite panel every year. It starts with the script and we had every single nominated person. You know,
wow.
from Emerald Fennell to Chloe Zhao and Aaron Sorkin and Darius Marder, who
well, no
actually
one wants
sort
to...
of charmed. He was very charming. He kind of took over
character.
The panel.
It's funny though because nobody wants to be the one that didn't show up, so they all have to. That's sort
they
of the
did
way the
exactly
works. Yeah.
Exactly. There was one who wasn't going to be there, and the publicist said, "Why haven't you asked this one?" And we said, "We did." yeah. So that was really great. And there are a lot of writer directors and you know Kemp Powers and it was really and the two Lucas brothers who are hilarious. The guys who came up with the idea for Judas and the Black Messiah. The idea that there was an FBI informant versus Fred Hampton, who was responsible for bringing him down.
Right.
Was
that's
their
sort of
idea.
The central concept of the movie. Yeah.
And it's how they turned it into a more commercial kind of you know, thriller as opposed to a biopic.
Right. Which is, it's a great.
And that's
point.
Why it's so accessible. That's why it's so, so much more, fun for people in a way, even if it's a tough story. It's inside the bucket of the trappings of an FBI thriller.
But how are the front runners doing? How's somebody like Chloe Zhao, who's had to be in promotional mode? You know, it's fascinating. This is a time of year where the great artists start to show the wear and tear of having to repeat themselves and do all this work they don't necessarily want to do promoting themselves. So how did that go?
I would say that they're all happy to be in the story. And Zhao has kept her appearances to a reasonable, a low roar. I mean, she hasn't been as ubiquitous as someone like Aaron Sorkin. where I really literally had trouble coming up with a question that he hadn't already answered at some point, you know.
I'm sure he could take it all in stride.
He did. Sort of he always does. Type. He always does. But Zhao told a story that I loved, which was the, other people may have heard this before, but I hadn't. The idea that when she was doing location scouting and went to the town, the deserted town that the Frances McDormand character leaves at the beginning, that she was location scouting and found the house that she actually ended up using in the movie. And, you know, walked around, opened the back door, looked out at that vista.
Like the scene in the movie.
Yeah. And she created the whole screenplay around the idea that that was the last scene of the movie. That's wow. How she adapted the book.
Well, that's great.
She
so you
knew
at,
where she was going.
It's funny. I mean, this is a very, people talk about Nomadland not necessarily having, you know, a big plot driven element going for it, but it actually is in a very subtle way a classical piece of storytelling. I mean, you look at the Sid Field approach to screenplay where it's like, know how your movie ends first and then build it out from there. And it
that's
does
what
seem
she did.
Like that's a great, great case study in that sense.
And she used the, as you say, she used the exact location, but it was the framing device for the movie. And the movie is written. She's very smart, Chloe Zhao. I mean, this is this goes without saying, but I mean, in the sense that when she's talking on the circuit, she gives you a very good sense of genuine authenticity that is not faked.
And
she comes up with new, very succinct, very pithy ways of saying things. I'm always interested in what she's saying.
That's the hardest thing, I think, for really talented filmmakers to learn. And it's significant, I think, that this is her third feature, right? I mean, she's a very particular director. There's an auteurist sensibility coursing through her work if you look at all three films. But it's hard for people with such a precise vision to figure out how to distill that into the media process of explaining yourself. And I assume that the first film and then especially the second film with the writer sort of helped her understand how to explain that to people in a way that doesn't just, you know, make their eyes glaze over or whatever.
But I'm also going to say something else. She gives the impression, at least, of being very happy. I mean,
which
she's in
good.
A great place.
At this time of the season,
she has nothing to be unhappy about. You know, she's got Marvel Eternals coming up.
China backlash.
She's about to break
worrying,
records but... and win like three Oscars, yeah. You know, assuming she gets all the, she could win four, but we'll see. But Nomadland is in very good shape to be the winner of at least picture and director. And this coming weekend, we have the DGA, expected to win.
But let's talk about SAG for a second, because that's behind us. And I saw the word upset used with SAG a few times in stories. And I thought that was curious because, yes, Trial won the top prize, but Nomadland wasn't even nominated. So if you looked at the films
upset
that were nominated,
wasn't used. I mean, some people said it.
I mean,
not about what won the Ensemble Award. I mean, because that was between Minari and Trial of Chicago 7 by default, because there were three movies that were not even nominated for Best Picture in the running.
Including
but was surprising, perhaps, was Viola Davis winning Best Actress. That's where the upset occurred. Although some people argued with me that wasn't an upset either.
I would question that too. I mean, she certainly, if there was going to be an upset, it would be that one, right? I mean, she is widely beloved. It is a powerful performance and it's been talked about.
Well, right now she's probably going to win Best Actress on that basis. But we didn't know that. We didn't know that because Ma Rainey has been failing. Ma Rainey has been slipping. It hasn't been winning things. It didn't make Best Picture. So you can see that the support for Ma Rainey actually is with the actors and the makeup branch. It's probably going to win makeup. It could be costumes. And you can see what I'm figuring out as I'm talking to more Academy members is that they are really tuned out. They have missed a lot of the movies. I'm shocked, actually. Usually by this point in the process, they've caught up with just about everything. Anything
really
they should have seen.
Because there's such a wide range of films at stake this year, and being an informed voter in some ways has never been more valuable than a year like this.
They don't care.
One.
a lot of them. I'm not saying this is true of everyone, but I can tell you that the people I spoke to just this week are people who are usually very engaged, usually 100% in the mix, totally passionate, you know, totally committed. Both of these people were largely checked out and I suppose had hardly seen the films.
From this anecdotal evidence, one could argue that the most aggressive campaigning could be even more effective than usual this year because because what I'm saying is if they're totally checked out, then they're probably more likely to notice things that are being thrust their way than to do the heavy work of really paying attention.
What's really clear to me is that even what you and I take for granted as journalists, I've been aware of this for a while. Journalists are way ahead of the Academy most of the time in terms of the movies they've seen, in terms of the awareness of the stories behind the movies.
Yeah.
We've been tracking this for a long time. And usually it takes a while that's our job. Usually it takes a while for the Academy members to catch up. This year, a lot of them don't have Roku. A lot of them don't have Apple TV. A lot of them barely have smart TVs. A lot of them are spoiled rotten by having all of the stuff just thrown at them that they don't have to go out and look for it.
Right. So the stuff that's most readily accessible.
And if you didn't have access, if you didn't have the ability to get onto the Academy portal, which is, and you don't want to watch movies on your laptop, didn't see Tenet. You didn't see any number of things because they weren't available.
Tenet isn't necessarily
if you didn't get
biggest...
it together to get HBO Max, which a lot of people still haven't done.
Right. So maybe that's a hit against
If you
Judas.
Didn't sign on to Disney Plus, you didn't see Saul. Mm-hmm. Think about that. If you didn't sign on to HBO Max, maybe if they sent you the screener, you saw Judas, maybe.
So it was an interesting question. I mean, something like Saul, it's like, okay, people might vote for that one anyway because it's the Pixar movie. Because if they didn't see Wolfwalkers either, which is, you know, they need Apple for that.
That's
why it didn't get screenplay. I mean, that's an interesting argument.
Well, that is a good point, Eric. Actually,
yeah,
that's a very good point.
I'm trying to extrapolate.
I think a lot of people didn't see Ma Rainey. I think a lot of for Best Picture voting. I mean, I think a lot of people didn't see. I think maybe what's going on is that the guilds. Maybe they were ahead of the actual Academy. I mean, it's like it was important to them to track the movies that were the best of the year in their field, right? But oh my God, I was actually kind of taken aback by some of the things I've been learning this.
Well,
this is
a weird season. No matter how much we dig into the nature of this being a weird season, I'm sure people will be surprised. There will be an internet backlash of sorts when things happen that seem off, like when Octopus Teacher potentially wins Best Documentary, and people on Twitter who realize that Time is a better movie or Collective become pissed off about it. They're not looking at the things you're looking at. So
let's remember that critics love Time and critics admire Time, and I do too, for all the ways that it plays with the genre and doesn't give you the answers that you expect to get, because that's not the story she wanted to tell, Gara Bradley. But there are a lot of people who want those answers in a conventional structured documentary. Remember that.
Well, let's dig into this one. Just a little detour on this, because you were writing about it this week. The hashtag Stop the Octopus is not trending right now, but maybe it should be.
You wish it would.
I don't want to. I mean, look, I'm sure the filmmakers are sincere in the story that they captured, which is a very sensitive study of this guy either having a midlife crisis or an erotic fixation on this cephalopod. But I do think that the challenge with this movie is that it happens to be. I'm okay with a lesser movie winning an Oscar conceptually. That's just the nature of the game. But it happens to be happening in a category in which at least three of these movies, I think, are some of the best movies of 2020 with collective mole aging.
I agree with you.
So it doesn't
have to
be this
you,
one.
I agree with you, Eric. Look, it does have to be this one. I mean, not because it's the best one, but because it's the one that touched people during the pandemic. It's the one they feel passionately about. It's the one
that actually
broke their hearts and made them feel better about themselves and made them feel like they were.
Mole aging should make you feel better about yourself. And
I
break
couldn't
your
agree
heart.
More. And I tried. I'm always selling the mole agent, believe me, and selling Collective and selling Crip Camp. These are movies I really, really care about. And I think they're I think they're all better than My Octopus Teacher. They are, because My Octopus Teacher is a really enjoyable, lovable, heartbreaking movie.
Disingenuous single source movie that throws science out the window.
Manipulative. I don't think it does, actually. When I interviewed the filmmakers, I queried them. I gave them some, they had to answer why they thought that Craig Foster understood the motivations of this octopus. How could he possibly know? And their answer to that was that it was his interpretation, and that they were telling the story from his point of view. The interview that makes the whole thing work is the structure that they hang the story on.
Yeah, but
they
that to be the problem of the movie. Is it that
you
that
can argue that it's heavy-handed. It's heavy-handed. No, but it's reductive. I will say that they went and checked with the scientists. They even checked with an octopus psychologist. And they insist that none of the interpretations that Craig Foster makes as to the behavior of the octopus, they are not scientifically impossible.
Wait, that's a bit of a stretch. I mean,
they're scientifically possible. They are.
It's more about the terms in which he describes and the anthropomorphic aspect.
I agree with you.
Anyway,
I had the same issue.
There is one category where I think I'd love to see it. I mean, certainly if Collective upsets an international, that would be a fascinating situation. But another round, man, you got like some heavy hitting filmmakers to talk about that movie this week. The love is in the air for that movie. And I think that's awesome. That's a really great one.
Absolutely. It helps you to see how the director's branch ended up nominating Thomas Vinterberg. That was an upset. And, it means that another round is in pretty good shape to win international feature. But for him to get director two was a big surprise. Although that branch often does put,
happened.
The odd Michael Haneke,
Pavel
Pedro Almodovar, they go with international. It's a very internationally based branch of the Academy. But it was so much fun. This is the most fun I've had in a long time. We had Guillermo del Toro and Mira Nair and Luca Guadagnino joining Thomas Vinterberg. And they were throwing a lot of love at him. And you could see how much respect they had. And it was ever since Festen, or A Celebration, as some of you may know it. And I just sat back and watched them go at it. It was really fun. It's a good movie.
Those.
It's a much more difficult movie than it looks to pull off, I think.
Yeah, and I love those kinds of conversations where it's like a bunch of people who do the same thing just geek out together, and you realize as a journalist, you could just like step out. You're like, okay, they've got it here.
We like panels like that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because the other end of the equation, I moderated an official Academy Q&A of sorts this past week. I don't want to say for which film, but it was an interesting experience because it was basically on Zoom with a bunch of, it was mostly actors. But it was like, instead of moderating a conversation, I was sort of facilitating it with the other people in the room. So anyone could kind of unmute themselves and be a part of the conversation. So they were trying to recreate an aspect of, an Academy Mixer event. But because it was on Zoom, they thought, okay, so we should have some sort of moderator in the room also to keep an eye on time and stuff. But people were cutting in. Like, there was one actress who just really wanted to ask all the questions, and she would just go to town. And then other people didn't really know. And then they had all their questions, of course, they thought of at the very end when we ran out of time. And it was just really interesting. I mean, some good stuff came out of it, but to try to rein that in, because, everyone just wanted to geek out together. And this format can be difficult for that, which leads into something else that I think we should talk about because of our live session last week. We didn't get a chance to return to the Academy Zooms thing, which I was sort of in favor of this idea of saying no Zooms for speeches, just because I thought, okay, so they're gonna try to control the style of the award show in a way that doesn't look cheap and isn't subject to technical failures and all this other stuff. So it sounds like there, as you said, there's some dispensation going on the Zooms front that they may allow some of that, but we still don't really know exactly what that means, because they also want to have options for people who can't travel from Europe in Paris and London.
Yeah.
So
they're going to do an updated press conference with the producers next week. So I'm very curious to see how that goes. And they've been, you can see that what they're trying to do is, if I were over at the Academy right now, I would be
terrified.
A little bit desperate. Yeah. Because the things I'm saying about how checked out people are, there was a story in the AP about, is this going to be the lowest rated, most ignored Academy Awards ever? And it could be, you know, there are a lot of movies right now in the conversation that you and I admire and revere, but they're not really, there is no sense of people just being passionately invested in what these movies are and who's going to win. And I would suggest the opposite. And so the people who are putting on the show are desperate to give us a reason to watch it, to think it's not just another Zoom show.
Yeah,
it's not just going to be a recreation of all these. I mean, I watched the African American Film Critics Awards last night, and it was charming. And Viola was given an award, and she was great. And George C. Wolfe was given an award, and he was great.
You wouldn't expect, you know, most of America to tune into that.
No. And you know, I enjoyed it, but. And I get a kick out of Daniel Kaluuya every time, because he's like Chloe Zhao. He's always genuine. He never reads a speech, but that's a secret that a lot of them should try to follow.
Yeah.
But the Oscars themselves, Union Station, trying to convince the actors they're going to be safe, what the protocols are going to be, moving people in and out of spaces on a rotating basis. There's going to be like a place where they're sitting watching a show, and then with, you know, distanced, and we don't know about masks yet. And then there's going to be another space where they get to hang out and have a cocktail party, which I think
he said bring your masks.
That's right.
Well, see, I think there's two different things though that we're talking about here. One is the experience of the nominees and how they choose to accommodate that and utilize their presence for the broadcast. And then there's making the broadcast compelling. And the question is, is one entirely reliant on the other? In other words,
I think it is. I think they've figured out that getting people shoulder to not shoulder to shoulder, literally, but getting them in the same room, looking at each other, is the secret of the Oscars, and it always has been. What do we care about what's on the stage?
Well,
we care about Meryl Streep and the selfie and people reacting
to
the big moment with Moonlight and La La Land.
But
we want the reaction to that.
But Moonlight and La La Land, I mean, you can't manufacture something like that. You can manufacture, like you say, like a Meryl Streep selfie moment. And the question is, what's the equivalent of that this year?
They're trying to get as close to that as they can. And I don't think they're going to get to it as close to it as they want to, because the travel restrictions, as you said, in Europe are punitive right now. And you can't ask people to do that.
So they're setting up
hubs in Paris and London
and trying to get
people to come to those.
It's not like the situation in Paris is particularly great for border crossing.
No,
I bet they abandoned Paris. but no, I was going to say, I mean, why did people tune in to the inauguration special hosted by Tom Hanks and so forth? I mean, it's like, I think if the best shot for this thing from a rating standpoint is that we need some messaging that this is a show that you need to watch, or that you would enjoy watching, not because you've seen the movies, but because of seeing some people perform or some kind of familiar faces or some sort of an event or experience. Can you cut a good trailer? Just give us
something. It's never the show, Eric. It's never the show.
But that's their best bet at this point.
There's nothing they can do at this point. The movies are always the driver of audience participation on in the Oscars. It's when it's Titanic. It's when it's Lord of the Rings.
That's the way it's been.
It's the way it's always been.
But I'm saying if there was something to do here, it would have to be about messaging that this is a show worth watching for some other reason, because
but there's something else going on.
Sell it.
There's something else going on with the Oscars, and I'm coming up with this for the first time, and forgive me if I'm not entirely articulate about it. But and I don't need your help talking me through
it.
But this is what I want to say. I want to think that the problems with the movie, the Hollywood problems that have been revealed by the pandemic that have to do with the theaters, I can't help but realize that so many of the movies that are good enough to be at the Oscars haven't been tuned into and haven't been experienced and haven't been talked about because they haven't been in theaters enough and they weren't given the proper platform and they didn't have all the buzz that goes around a theatrical release. And I think that the problems in the movie industry itself have been brought into relief here too, in the sense that, that they don't really make the movies the way they used to. They don't really they're shifting their platforms. They're shifting the way that they show them. They're abandoning in many ways theaters. We'll see how temporary that is and how permanent that is. And I think that the Oscars have been impacted by that. But the Oscars were on a downslope anyway, in terms of audience participation. Mm-hmm. It had become a blue kind of politically correct kind of Oscars that a lot of people complain about. I believe in all of the themes and all of the things that liberal Democrats believe in. But I also understand that while pursuing all of that and sending those messages, they have alienated a great big portion of the American public who might want to go to the movies, but don't want to go to the Oscars.
Well, I think but culturally what you're hitting on is a bigger imperative for the industry also to make the movies that have resonated with the Academy, like a Parasite, for example, to somehow cross over and have a bigger resonance with a society that might not notice those movies because they have a different set of values that drives the kinds of things that they do as passive viewers. So that's a bigger systematic problem than the Oscars or even the film industry itself, but it's certainly one that is worth sussing out and shows you that there is, as ever, a disconnect between Hollywood and the rest of this country. And
that's why I remain
we'll
sort
happens.
Of moved by Borat. I remain moved by that because he was really genuinely trying to figure out a way to make a movie.
It's a Trojan horse.
Would connect with everyone.
Yeah.
And reach and everyone.
It
and
worked.
Show people the best of humanity. And I loved that clip you did with Maria Bakalova
and the babysitter, Janice Jones. That was amazing. Yeah, people should look that up if they didn't see it. So
I was moved by it, actually. I thought it was really interesting.
I
she's playing
great.
A part. She was playing a part and she felt moved by this woman who was so much nicer and more humane and generous than she ever would have expected her to be.
Yeah. And they only shot for a day together. But I think something about the nature of that dynamic and not being able to reveal her real self in it enhanced the emotional connection that happened there, because she had to lie and yet was still receiving generosity from this woman. And, you know, Janice, I think, has come around to realize it's such a strange thing. You can't imagine what that's like, realizing you're in a movie without understanding it. But I think because of the underlying intentions of it, seems like she has accepted what it is. And that's an amazing thing to see. It's so
it was interesting, I have to say, because
level.
it also reveals the challenge and the difficulty of what she was trying to do and what the whole movie was trying to do. I think very few people, I talked to the Borat writers this week also, so very few people recognize the real challenge that went into making that movie. When I asked the writers if they wanted to make Borat 3 at the end, and Sacha Baron Cohen, they all looked like they got hit by a truck. They all looked like they were experiencing PTSD.
One of those writers was working on Who Is America, and you could argue that with that show, Sasha was making variations of what Borat 2 did each week. I mean, this is activism in the guise of satire or using satire as activism. It just happens to have a kind of a lowbrow feel to it, which is really why it ends up crossing over in a really amazing way. So there's a lot you can glean from that approach in general. And maybe it'll make a difference for other comics and comedic storytellers that a movie like this could get Oscar nominations and this kind of appreciation and so forth. So,
well, if you get down to it, I think what he really cared about, as you said all along, was maybe having an impact on the election.
In the short time that we have left, I think we should circle back with one major movie theater story that we just haven't had enough time to dig into. And that is, of course, Godzilla versus Kong, which
my favorite.
Saw at home.
My favorite movie.
I felt within the first 10 seconds, I should be seeing this in IMAX. I don't know why I'm not seeing this in IMAX. And is it even worth it not to see it in IMAX? And I can't say it really was. I did enjoy the fight at the end. The lighting off of the Tokyo skyscrapers and so forth was beautiful. I found the movie overall to be
Weren't they in
pretty,
Hong Kong?
Hong Kong, thank you. But you know, the same kind of thing, those neon lights and the all that kind of stuff. The CGI certainly delivered. I found it just kind of dull overall and not very innovative in terms of what it could do. I mean, you have this whole sequence, and I doubt I'm spoiling it because I'm sure people who care have already seen it, where Kong is in, you know, in a different Earth at the core of our Earth, basically, where there's all this crazy gravity stuff.
The hollow
happening.
Earth.
The hollow Earth, right? So you're a bigger fangirl than I am, but he escapes that Hollow Earth for the battle. There's no battle in that. All he does is go to the Hollow Earth and have some mopey moment where he remembers his family, and then he has to go above ground to have the fight. He should have dragged Godzilla back into that thing where it's like the rules are all crazy, and then
well,
you
at least
have good
in the
action.
Last, in the least in the last five. Here's the thing: the movie is totally set up as Team Kong, and if you're a VFX aficionado, you will recognize how well Kong is done. I mean, it's extraordinary what they did with him, and the way that they used the sort of world wrestling moves for the fights with the two. I mean, we recognize the moves that they are using in their fights, which I don't think they've ever done that before. So that makes him even more anthropomorphized. We're identifying with him as a warm mammal who has feelings,
just like
cares
octopus
for the
teacher.
Little girl. That's right. Exactly right. And,
it all
and
makes
Godzilla
sense now.
Is a cold-blooded reptile who thrives underwater, right? So in the very first, my favorite scene is actually the first fight where Kong is chained to the boat and the ship. And he gets pulled down and goes down to fight Godzilla, but he has to get rid of all the chains, and Alexander Skarsgård has to dive under and release the locks and let him out, and they go at it. But Kong has to breathe. Kong is a mammal. That's part of our identification with him. So,
yeah,
so I'm rooting for him all the way. And
his name comes first. Everybody roots for Kong first, but the movie kind of plays with that dynamic in a way that I thought was kind
of simplistic. Isn't it Godzilla versus Kong?
Yeah, but I mean, at the end of the day, everybody roots for Kong.
Of course.
It's the nature of it. Godzilla generally is seen as a threat. I mean,
I spoke about this before, but just seeing it on the big screen made such a big difference. The whole thing envelops you. You're caught up
right.
in it. You're escaping into it. And
you
I highly recommend seeing
some
it
of the
in the theater.
Exposition.
I can't imagine watching that movie on TV.
Yeah.
I just can't.
Some of it was just, I think it's interesting how it treats the universe, the monsterverse, as like Star Wars or something. Like there's so much plot going on that's totally irrelevant to why anyone would care.
And
about
that whole subplot
here.
With the kids and
Brian Terry Henry's character is like a conspiratorial podcast host.
I couldn't even hear
what they were saying a lot of times.
And how they ended up in the Hollow Earth was crazy. But Wingard, the director, understood perfectly well where the set pieces were and that it was all about those.
Yeah, I mean, I almost wonder how much he directed it versus CGI people. I couldn't really discern the, you know, I've enjoyed.
There's actually a really good commentary on the New York Times site. There, you know, he goes, oh, you'll see. Go watch it. It's cool.
Their Anatomy of the Scene feature. I mean, it's just fascinating to me. When directors who have made these really entertaining movies on a smaller scale, I love Your Next. The Guest is pretty fun. I didn't see that.
I saw The Guest. That was well done.
Maybe he figured out some ways of using the art of CGI to do some innovative things, but I just didn't see the same sort of spark of ingenuity that I saw in those films. And that's always what's challenging on this scale is how do you even get that in there? Where is there room for that in the frame?
When what I really was in a theater the where everyone was cheering and applauding, and it felt good.
I might have cheered at certain points too. That part is fun. I'm going to go to the movies next week. I'm fully vaxxed by next Friday. I'm trying to figure out, is it going to be Tarkovsky's The Mirror? Or is it going to be Minari,
which form.
I haven't seen on screen since last Sundance? Maybe I'll do both. I'll do a double bill and mix it all up. In any case, so next week, we'll have a chance to talk about BAFTAs, which should be interesting as another aspect of this, the British Academy.
That is also this weekend.
And we're going to try to watch the short films. We've got a blind spot.
I'm getting there. I'm catching up.
One step at a time. Well, Anne, I hope you enjoy your semi-virtual experience up in Santa Barbara. And
thank you.
Have fun up there, and I'll see you next week.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.